Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Joe Harrington, and I was sitting in for Reggie Corrigan on the very last Dublin's Talking Sport of 2021, and I can promise you it was a great show. We were honoured to have golfing sensation Leona Maguire. What a year 2021 has been for her. She spoke about that. In rugby, Philip Doyle, the former Irish women's rugby team coach, shared his thoughts and explained all the issues with women's rugby and the IRFU. In football, Alan Cawley lent his full support to Stephen Kenny to get an extended contract with the FAI. We also had a chat about the Nations League and the group the Republic of Ireland are in. The opposition is the Ukraine, Scotland and Armenia. GAA, Declan Drake sat down with Ballinteer St John's clubman Cormac Goggins to get his thoughts and opinions on Dublin's turbulent year of 2021 in Gaelic football. Enjoy the show, spread the word and tell your friends we're on Apple and Spotify. Before I go, on behalf of Ken Doherty, Reggie Carr, our producer Jane McNamara, I'd like to wish you a very, very happy Christmas and a peaceful new year. And we'll see you in the new year.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm not too bad, Ken. Not too bad at all. Poor old Reggie's isolating, so he's...
Poor old Reggie is isolating. Yeah. But I think his wife and kids are happy, though. Yeah, so that's a good thing. There's always a silver lining, you know?
Oh, you're an awful man. Well, there you go. Anyway, Ken, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. First of all, obviously, the snooker, the Grand Prix in Coventry. Let us know what's happening there.
Well, we had a wonderful semi-final last night between two of the greats of the game, Robertson and Selby. Robertson came through 6-3 in the end, so he's into the final, and he awaits the other semi-final, which is played tonight. There's no afternoon session today, and that's Ronnie O'Sullivan against Stuart Bingham. Ronnie O'Sullivan playing Stuart Bingham, both from Essex. As Stephen Hendry said yesterday, the only way is Essex for this semi-final. But it should be another classic. I mean, we have four world champions in the last four. It's the last tournament, obviously. It's a big one as well, the Grand Prix. It's only the top 32 players on the one-year list. So it's a bit like sort of, you know, a race for Dubai type of thing. They chop it down the top 32, and then it goes into the top 16, and then it goes into the top 8 for the very final Tour Players Championship at the end. So this is a big tournament, and whoever wins it will be guaranteed to be playing the other two as well. So Robertson's in the final, and O'Sullivan and Bingham playing the semi-final tonight, so it should be a cracker.
So this is the end of kind of snooker for the year, is it, Ken?
Well, there's some Champions League going on next, starting from Monday, would you believe, for a few days. But this is the last major before the year, so it's played in the Coventry Arena here. It's actually where Coventry City play. There used to be the old Rico Arena, and it's played in the one of the big halls here, part of the old Coventry City football stadium. But it's really, really nice. It's fantastic, and looking forward to the semi-final tonight.
And I know you're doing it on ITV. We don't get the ITV now since the whole Virgin Media thing came in, but so between the BBC and ITV now covering a lot of the majors, snooker, I think, a bit of a comeback, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's getting a lot of viewers. Yeah, I mean, ITV are really pleased with it. They started off with three tournaments. They're up to five now already for this season alone. Of course, BBC have just got the three, the Masters, which will be played in January, the UK we've just played last month, and of course the World Championships as well in April, and finishing on Bank Holiday May. So it's quite good. But ITV, it's great to see. I mean, ITV were very active, of course, in the 80s and the 90s, and then sort of left snooker for a good, like, maybe 10 or 15 years, and then came back about 10 years ago. So it's great. It's great to have them back. They do a really good job.
And I've noticed even on Eurosport, they have Jimmy White, and they have a little bit of a panel, and they seem to be getting more involved as well. And they have, a studio there and everything. You know, before they used to just kind of do blanket coverage and take breaks, and it was only commentators. But now they have analysis as well, like the BBC and like ITV as well.
Yeah, exactly. Jimmy White, Ronnie O'Sullivan, Alan McManus, Neil Fowles are there. So, yeah, no, it's doing really well. The figures are really, really good, you know. And so it's continued to get great viewing figures across Europe and of course, into Asia as well and the Middle East. And even, I mean, snooker's beamed into North America now and of course, into South America even, where they have got great viewing figures as well. You wouldn't expect that, but they do. And Brazil is supposed to be very, very popular for snooker, you know, and they play on like on smaller tables. There's a lot of smaller tables out there, like 9x5 or 6x3 tables, but it's still quite popular.
They don't play in the beaches or anything like the Copacabana.
No, but I'm hoping for a tour out there at some stage, shall we? If I need somebody to carry me cue, I'll give you a shout.
I will. Yeah, don't worry about Mick McLean. No, forget Mick McLean.
That'd be good fun.
So that's great. And what about yourself, Ken? I know you've been sort of practicing and trying to get back in. And for 2022, what's your aspirations?
Well, there's a lot of tournaments still on the go. I still have 1 year left on the tour. So, just hoping. I'm still enjoying it, Joe. Still loving it. It gets a little bit harder, of course, as you get a bit older. But I might as well enjoy it while I'm in the sort of twilight of my years as regards snooker is concerned. But I'm still enjoying it. I'm just going to play out this year and see how it goes and then make an assessment at the end of the year, you know. But it's, keep going as far as I can.
I was out and about last night with my brother, and on the big screen where we were, the darts was on, and I was just looking at the couple of the guys throwing the darts. Now, I don't know much about it, but they looked about 15 or 16. You know, they look so young.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
they're getting younger. Gone are the days of the old Jockey Wilson and you know, John Lowe and Eric Bristow, those days. Yeah, but no, darts is. Darts has gone incredibly popular as well.
But these guys were hitting trebles all the time, and they're young fellas and completely thin, skinny, fit, all that sort of stuff. No more beer bellies, Ken.
No. I mean, it's changed exponentially, darts, over the last 10 years, you know? And the coverage and, of course, the crowds at it as well. And that's down to Barry Hearn, who took over snooker 10 years ago. So he's done a great job with both sports. I mean, you look at the darts, and it's played down in Alexander Palace where the Masters is played. When that finishes, the darts finishes, the snooker moves in straight away for setup on the 8th of January. But yeah, no, it's incredible. And the darts always around, you know, Christmas time and going into January for the World Championship. The atmosphere there, you know, the amount of crowds they get, it's just incredible, you know. And it's great to see what they've done to their own sport. And indeed, what he's done to snooker over the last, 10 years is quite incredible.
And just a quick look at the Nations League draw. Ireland.
Yeah.
What did you make of that? And
I think it's a good draw, I think. You know, I mean, Scotland are in there, Armenia and Ukraine. I mean, tough away draws. You know, Scotland would be quite interesting as well, but they've got a good side. You know, they did really well in the Euros. And of course, they're in the playoff for the world as well. So, yeah, I think, as good a draw, I suppose, as Stephen Kenny could have hoped for. Still going to be tough. You know, the Ukraine are a good side. They did very well as well. Quarterfinals, I think they got in the Euros under Shevchenko. But yeah, I think it could have been a lot tougher.
Yeah,
And I think he'd be quite pleased with it. You know, I'm really pleased for Stephen Kenny. I know there's still contract negotiations going on until Germany 2024. I think he's done really well with Ireland. There's some really great, green shoots of improvement there. And he's got some great young players coming through. And, it'd be great to see how they do now next summer in that Nations League. It's a really good idea, actually, you know.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Group A, where England's group, and they have Italy, Germany, and Hungary. That's going to be some group. And I tell you one thing, I'm sure that a lot of the security forces in the various countries will be looking at that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully everything will be okay by then. And of course, you know, it'd be great to for things to be back to normal in all aspects of sport and people, audiences, attendance and spectators or whatever. So, there's some great groups, and that is a fantastic group as well for England. But I think Stephen Kenny be really pleased with his group, and hopefully, the contracts will be sorted out by then.
Good morning, Leona.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. Now, I suppose the first thing is to say congratulations on the nomination for Sports Person of the Year tonight. And it's absolutely an incredible lineup, mostly ladies, which is great, and just a couple of guys. So I want to wish you the best of luck on that. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, it's a huge honour to be nominated. I think the special thing about this year's list is that everybody on the list has pretty much achieved the pinnacle of your sport. And I think a lot of people have an idea of who's going to win. But no, look, just to be on that list is a huge honour. And I have a massive amount of respect of every single person who's on that list and what they've achieved. And I don't really see how you can compare, I suppose, Rachel winning a Grand National or Kelly winning an Olympic gold medal or any of those to a Solheim Cup or that. But it's phenomenal to see so many Irish people achieving great things on a world stage this year.
Well, I looked at, looking down the list, Leona, it is, as you say, phenomenal list, and every individual has done so brilliantly in their own field. You're right. There's whoever wins it. I think talking to Ken Doherty earlier on, he just said every single person that on the list deserves to win it, because they've achieved phenomenal stuff. I know you've had a brilliant year, but I wanted to go back and just for maybe people who didn't realise this, that when you were starting out in the sport, obviously your parents and your dad encouraged you and your sister, but maybe a lot of people didn't realise at one stage you could have been a swimmer. So tell us what made you decide, or how did you change tack from maybe being a swimmer to being a golfer in your early days?
Yeah, I mean, we played all kinds of sport growing up, me and Lisa. We played Gaelic football, soccer, basketball. We were involved in a lot of competitive swimming, and Lisa broke her elbow when we were about 10 or 11, and the specialist told Dad racket sports would be a good idea to get involved in, and Dad quite enjoyed his golf. We grew up next to Steve Russell here in Cavan, so there was a 9-hole par 3 course, and we started off playing around that with 3 clubs, and it kind of snowballed from there. And I suppose it got to the point where there just wasn't enough hours in the day to be going to swimming training twice a week and play golf and go to football training and all the rest. So I suppose as we started to get a bit older and a bit better at golf, kind of decisions had to be made. And on a Saturday there was clashes with swim meets and golf competitions and yes, football matches. So bit by bit we chose golf more often.
Well, then, and throughout your career, you've had lots of tussles with your sister Lisa. And did it ever get personal, or like were you, did you ever fall out over any competitions when you were growing up?
No, I mean, obviously we both wanted to win. We're both very competitive, but I suppose that was the thing. That competitiveness probably brought each other on without realizing it. We practiced together, and she beat me one day. I wanted to beat her the next, and like you said, we came up against each other in a few finals. But it was competitive on the course, but that's where it stayed. And if I didn't win, I wanted her to win.
Fantastic. Now, I want to sort of get back to, we could go through your career and we'd be here forever, but I wanted to get back to 2021 and that Solheim Cup and that phenomenal performance by you, and also going up the rankings. First of all, tell us about the whole Solheim Cup and your experience and how you felt about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible week. It was probably one of the best weeks of my life. Just to be there and to lead it, to make the European team was a massive honour. And I suppose that the confidence that Beanie and the captains put in me as a rookie, picking me for the team. I'd had a very good year this year and I knew I was in good form heading into it, but never expected to play 5 matches and to win that many points. I suppose beating the quarters that first morning out in that sort of against their golden pair that had been unbeaten from the previous time. So I suppose that got things underway and kind of never looked back from there.
Okay, and I was just noted that when you went to university with your sister that I got a degree in psychology, and I was wondering, does psychology help you in the game?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I think psychology is a massive part of any sport, but I suppose golf in particular, golf's a game of inches, and sometimes those inches are on the golf course and sometimes it's between your two ears. But yeah, I mean, golf's one of those games where even if you're at the very, very top of the game, you lose more than you win. So you very much have to sort of keep that positive mindset and a short memory almost. Mm. Focusing on one shot at a time, I suppose, as the cliche goes.
Yeah, and what would you say has been your greatest challenge in your career so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's anytime you move up the levels, I suppose there's always something new to learn and adjust to. And moving to America to go to college was definitely a big adjustment, as was leaving college and having to sort of rebuild. This was where you're in an environment in college where you've everything looked after, you've all the coaches, you've all the facilities, everything, whereas when you turn pro you're kind of out on your own and you have to figure it out. So definitely adjusting to pro life was very different, learning how to cope with all the travel and the pro-ams and all the scheduling and the demands that goes with professional life. It's maybe not as glamorous as people think it is. And as with the last 2 years have been tough, being in bubbles and having to stay in your hotel room and all of that. But no, I mean, I'm very lucky to do what I do. So there's been plenty more positives than there has been negatives.
And trying to keep a discipline during these COVID times and trying to keep a strict regime and stuff. Just give us an idea of, you know, what sort of, just people often wonder about professional sports people, you know, what time they train or practice, how often they do it, and when is your time out in any given 7 days?
Yeah, I mean, we're basically ticking over the whole time, I suppose. Golf's a very time-demanding sport. There's all the different aspects. So, yeah, I mean, you'd be putting anywhere between 8 to 10 hours in a day. The off-season, I'll be in the gym six times a week. So, generally, for me, I get Mondays off because that's usually the day after a tournament. So, yeah, for us, you never like to have the weekends off. So Monday's usually a travel day or the day to sort of take it easy, and obviously rest and recovery is a big part of it, given the demands of our schedule and how long the year is and all the travel involved. But yeah, I mean, it's time demanding, but I enjoy what I do. So you don't mind putting in those hours, and ultimately that's what you have to do to get the results.
And what about diet and that sort of stuff, and sticking to, you know, I presume this types of food you eat and types of, you know, and keeping fit. I presume you do gym work and other stuff outside of golf.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big part of it too, making sure your body's ready to go and be able to deal with all the demands. I mean, we'd be out in the golf course for anywhere between 4.5 to 6 hours. So making sure you're hydrated and fully ready to go both before, during and after. And I mean, I work with Sharon Madigan, the Irish Olympic nutritionist, on that, and she's been a huge help to me. And yeah, it's the whole package really, I suppose, making sure you've all the boxes ticked to make sure you can perform at that level week in, week out.
And what sort of advice would you give to anybody who's listening at the moment, maybe an aspiring junior golfer, and you know, what advice could you give to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing is to enjoy it. I think the more you enjoy something, the more time you'll be willing to dedicate to it, and that time you put in, I suppose, will help you down the line. I definitely say, in terms of golf, to practice your short game, that's where the big gains are to be made. It's maybe not the most exciting thing to practice your chipping and your putting and stuff, but
You've achieved an incredible amount. You've gone you're into the top 50 in you know, ranked in the world now. Going into 2022, do you think it's going to be a big challenge for you to continue on an upward spiral?
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything, I suppose. The LPGA is probably as strong as it's ever been. The standard is very, very high, and it's getting higher every year. There's so many girls on any given week that can win an LPGA event. I mean, I shot over 20 under par a couple of times this year, and it wasn't good enough to win. So, yeah, I mean, I'll continue to work hard and try and improve my game as much as I can, and work my way up those rankings and keep putting myself in contention to win events.
And I was just to slightly go back to your time in college in the States. You achieved a huge amount over there as well. Were they kind of surprised that about Ireland producing such phenomenal golfers? You know, both male and female as well. Or you know, because America is and the US is really big on golf, and the fact that when you went over there, you were suddenly winning everything in college. Was that a big surprise, or did they have an idea of who you were when you went over?
I don't know, to be honest. I suppose the Coach Brooks that recruited myself and Lisa to Duke, I mean, he obviously knew the credentials we came with, and he was hoping for us to make an impact on the team and to ultimately win as much as we could. So that's the reason we were there. But yeah, I mean, Ireland has a rich tradition and history of great players and great golf courses, and the Americans love to come over and play and really enjoy that, the Irish connection. So yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of major winners and all that on the men's side, so it probably wasn't too much of a shock. But at the same time, we haven't had many Irish ladies competing in America either.
Yeah, and of course a fantastic performance, as I said, in the Solheim Cup. But the money now in the LPGA has never been better, so I suppose your timing couldn't have been better to now that the sort of professional money for women has gone up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I've never been doing it for the money. I do it because it's what I love to do, and that's just a bonus. I mean, there is a long way to go to even get a percentage of what the men are getting. I mean, Patrick Cantlay got $15 million this year for winning the FedEx Cup, and Jin Young got $1.2 million for winning ours. So there is a huge gap. The lads are earning obscene amounts of money, but at the same time, like I said, I don't do it for the money. I do it because it's what I enjoy doing, and I couldn't imagine myself doing anything else.
Okay, well, listen, I just want to more or less wrap up now, Leona, but I want to say a big thank you for coming on Dublin's Talking Sport this morning. I want to wish you the very, very best of luck tonight in the Sports Person of the Year. And just my final question is, just going forward in 2022, for you, what would be the big thing for 2022?
Yeah, I mean, obviously looking forward to another year. Hopefully we'll be a bit more or less restricted going in and out of countries, and there'll be a bit of a bigger schedule. Looking forward to going back to the US Open of Pine Needles, back to North Carolina. That's one that I've sort of circled on the calendar that I'm looking forward to. And I mean, all the major venues this year are incredible. Congressional for the KPMG, Championship Muirfield for the British Open. I think it's going to be a very exciting year, and just looking forward to getting back out and competing again.
Okay, well, listen, congratulations on a phenomenal year, and thank you once again for joining us this morning, Leona Maguire. Thank you very much, Leona.
Thank you.
Football now with Alan Cawley. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm great. Good to talk to you. We will talk Premiership in just a moment, but I know whatever's going to, they'll probably be cancelled by the time I get round to the conversation because of COVID across the water. But I want to, first of all, get your thoughts on the Nations League draw and Stephen Kenny's contract. So let's start with the Nations League draw. What did you make of it?
Yeah, so the draw was obviously made during the week, Joe, as we've all seen. So I think it could have been a lot worse, and it probably could have been a little bit better. It's probably somewhere in between, middle of the road. And the teams that are in, obviously the group with us, Ukraine, Armenia and Scotland, they're teams that are probably all capable of taking points off each other. I think obviously everyone's going to look at the Scotland one in terms of the fact that they're one of our nearest neighbours. So I think that'll make for a couple of great games, both home and away, in terms of revenue for the FAI and ticket sales and all that kind of thing. And it'll generate a lot of hype. But also the fact on the football side of things, Scotland are very good at the moment as well. And they obviously qualified for the Euros. Steve Clarke has done a good job. So that'll be a tough game. Ukraine also, something similar, will be very tough. And we should be hopefully beating the likes of Armenia. But just listening to Stephen Kenny's comments after the draw and even in the lead up to it as well, Joe, he's going to focus heavily on this because there's a lot at stake in the Nations League in terms of rankings, and obviously there's promotion relegation involved now because this has literally replaced kind of meaningless friendlies, which has been a good addition to the calendar as well. And also there's the added incentive that if you were to top the group, it should secure you a playoff spot as well for the European Championships, which obviously we're looking to qualify for the following year as well. So there's a lot at play, a lot at stake in terms of Stephen as well. The fact that he's coming off the end of a strong, he finished the campaign very strong. He'll be hoping to carry on that momentum into the Nations League, which he's built up. And I'm looking forward to it. I think think it's a good draw. The only thing I would add that makes it even a little bit more difficult, in, and not even in terms of being on the pitch, it's just the scheduling. If you look at, there's 4 games in 10 days in June, which is going to be very, very busy, very hectic time. And one of them is away, first of all, in Kiev. Then you're back to Dublin for a game. Then you're away to Yerevan, another long journey, long distance travel. And then you're back again for the fourth game in Dublin. So that's going to be a really hectic schedule for the players and for Stephen, and just to navigate that. But in terms of, as I say, the campaign itself, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I was looking at Ukraine in the, was it, what's the last one? Is it the World Cup or the Euro? The Euros. I wasn't impressed.
I wasn't impressed
with them at all. And I think we could beat them for sure. Because didn't England give them, hammer them when they did get, they qualified, but I've just been watching them.
Yeah, they weren't
very good.
England beat them 4-0, I think, that night in the European game, yeah. So, it's a game, as I say, Joe, like, I suppose people, we can't get too carried away in the fact that, like, England are on a completely different level to us, but I don't think we have the divine right in that, and what we've seen with results lately and where we're at and where we're Stephen is starting from, that we think we could beat anyone. So they'll all be tough games no matter who we play against. But I just think the momentum that Stephen has built up off the end of the last campaign and the introduction of obviously all the new players and the excitement around a lot of those new young players, I just think there's lots to be optimistic about. And I think you were at the Portugal game as well, Joe, were you? The sellout game with Ronaldo. Yeah, and even you could get the sense that night that the general public are all behind Stephen. They're all behind this young team. They want to see them do well. That's all good and well. At the end of the day, you still have to get results. But I'd be very optimistic about what's to come for this team. And hopefully, as I say, they can carry on that momentum that they built up at the end of the last campaign and bring it into that Nations League. So it should be an exciting summer for us.
Indeed, I'm looking forward to it. And I suppose it's important that he's got injuries. Injury free, and then a lot of the players getting regular football. Now, I noticed that Duffy's been with a great start with Brighton, has been sort of in and out of the team there. I know he got suspended there recently, but there's a few players that are not quite making the cut. And I know Aaron Connolly was playing the other evening for Brighton, and he didn't do that great. Who's that? That's your dog.
The dog's going mad about the Nations League campaign, Joe. You know, even the dog is getting excited with the way I'm talking.
I know. It's the whole COVID lockdown and all. But listen, just to get back to that, Aaron Connolly got a rare start the other night for Brighton, and by all accounts didn't impress. So I suppose it's important that all our Irish players are getting as much regular football.
Yeah, and that's the tricky thing for Stephen, because it's all good and well when they come over here, and obviously Stephen has them for 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever it is, the time frame. But when they go back to their clubs, he has no control over that, Joe, and he's dependent on obviously managers and people giving players opportunities. If they're doing well, like you look at Jeff Hendrick, who's had a bit of a resurgence as well under Stephen and done really well in the last few games, but he's not getting a look in at Newcastle. So that's the hard part of the job for Stephen, and the frustration, I'd say, that when he tunes in on a Saturday to assess his players and to see who's playing and to have a look at them. The majority of them, unfortunately, are not getting a game and not getting game time. We obviously saw with Adam Ida, who was literally learning on the job at international football, which is very, very difficult for a young lad. But he goes back to his club at Norwich. Now, he's had the odd chance in the last few games, and you could argue that he probably hasn't taken that opportunity and chance, but it's limited game time for a lot of them. And I just think that adds to the whole conversation regarding Stephen, Joe, in the sense that if you think of the pool of players that he's picking from, which is limited enough as it is, and he's trying to introduce a lot of these young lads, but then if you add in the fact that a lot of them are not getting game time at their clubs, and he's expected to wave a magic wand then when they come over here and spend 2 weeks or 10 days or whatever it is around the international break, it's very, very difficult, and it just adds to the difficulty of the job for Stephen. So in all, kind of when you add in all those factors, that's why I'm all for Stephen and think he's doing a very good job when you add in all those things. And as I say, the momentum that he built up off the back of the last campaign, he'll be under a bit of pressure to carry that on now, but I think he will carry it on, and hopefully he will. But it is, you're right, it's very frustrating and difficult when you see lads not getting games at their clubs.
Absolutely, and according to the newspapers, he says the idea of a short-term deal doesn't make sense, so he's looking for the long contract. Do you suspect he'll get the long contract?
Yeah, he should do, Joe, because I suppose you look at the position that he's in at the moment, and there's a lot of speculation around it and debate in terms of the fact that should he get it or should he not get it. I absolutely am in no doubt whatsoever he should get it, and he will get it. The talk is that he will get it, but I suppose they're just haggling over the length or what they're prepared to commit to. But like everyone, Joe, when you go in and negotiate with your employer, he has a value, Stephen Kenny, and he should realise that, and I'm sure he does realise that. And it's not just a case of, oh, we'll just give it because he may not have other options in the fire, that he should just accept whatever they're offering. As I say, he's there on merit. People can argue over the results or how well he's going in terms of the job itself. But if you look at towards the end of the campaign, and as I said, the difficulty that he has with players and the limited pool that he's picking from, and yet he's still introducing a lot of these young players that people are excited about. I think he deserves a good contract, and he deserves a good go at not just the Nations League but the European campaign as well. How could you give him just a 2-month contract? Sure, that would be ridiculous. I've never heard of that before, and I don't think that'll be the case, but it's just a case of maybe whatever they're haggling over in terms of money and what the FEI, we all know they're strapped for cash and what they're prepared to commit to a long term for Stephen. But when you think of the money some of the other previous managers were on, I think Stephen should hold out for exactly what he deserves, because he has a value like everyone else.
I agree, and I think he is a great manager, and I think there's great excitement at the way Ireland are playing, and you know, and the passing game and the whole lot. I know at a different level, but I think it augurs well for the future. I just want to briefly go on to the Premiership, because a lot of matches not on, but just to run through who you fancy. There's a 3 o'clock kickoff with Villa, Burnley. Both of them, I suppose Burnley in more trouble, and Villa, of course, doing pretty okay at the moment, Alan.
Yeah, Villa had a great start under Steven Gerrard, and he's someone who I'm really impressed with. Obviously, we all know him as the superstar that he was when he played and that iconic Premier League figure. But since he's taken to management, first of all, obviously with the job he did at Rangers, he was very successful in toppling Celtic. And now he's taken the opportunity to come back to the Premier League and take over a big club like Villa. And he's had a great start. I think it's 4 wins out of 6 since he's come in. And he's really been a massive addition to them. So I'm really impressed with him, Joe. And I fancy them to beat Burnley. Burnley, as you say, are struggling. They tend to struggle most seasons. And I think Sean Dyche does a great job off limited resources to just keep them in the division. And that'll be the same this year. I think he will keep them up, but it's always a struggle. But I do think Gerrard has had a major impact, not only on Villa, but on the Premier League itself. And I think he's going places, Joe. Everybody will look further down the line in terms of maybe one day him taking over Liverpool. I think right now the way he's going about his development and how he's going about it as well and how he conducts himself, yeah, I think he's been absolutely fantastic, and he's had a major impact to Villa, and he's probably put them in the reckoning now. For maybe you look at the top three who are all exceptional, and they've broken away from the rest, yes, and everybody is maybe challenging now for that fourth position, and there's probably 4 or 5 teams who you would say are challenging for that realistically, the likes of United, Spurs, Arsenal, and maybe West Ham. Yes. But I think Villa have just hung on to their coattails because of the start that Gerrard has had. And if he keeps up the momentum that he's built up and goes on the run, stays on the run that he's on, I think they could be in the mix for that as well. I think he's done a great job.
Okay, and just very briefly, because 1 minute, the three big guns, City, Chelsea, Liverpool, all away, City to Newcastle, Chelsea to Wolves, and Liverpool, Tottenham. Do you see wins for all three?
Tough games, Joe. I think City will win. We saw City during the week. They were absolutely fantastic, winning 7-0 against Leeds. So they'll beat Newcastle. I think it's tougher for Liverpool and Chelsea. Chelsea have hit a bit of a wobble at the moment, and that's a tough game away to Wolves. And the same with Liverpool as well, even though Spurs are COVID hit. But Conte has done a good job since he's come in as well. So that'll be a tough game. But it'll be them three fighting it out at the end, Joe. The three of them are miles ahead of the rest. So I know you just said to me, I have a minute. So that's about 40 seconds, is it, Joe? So I've done well.
It is. And you have a minute to tell me who you think will win the RTE Sports Person of the Year. And I give you the candidates: Rachel Blackmore, Kelly Harrington, Ellen Keane, Keane Lynch, Leona Maguire, Jason Smith, Katie Taylor, Vicky Wall. Everyone probably deserves to be a winner, but it's a popular vote. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's brilliant, Joe. And it's great to see so many female girls that are obviously looking to In contention for win. Have had unbelievable years, all of them, and you could argue a case for all of them. Obviously, Kelly Harrington, and Katie Taylor, we saw her last week as well, has been a superstar for years now. But my standout for that is Rachel Blackmore. I think she'll clean up on all the awards, the individual awards this year. I think she won the Independent Sports Award during the week as well. And I think she'll win that. She's absolutely amazing. I think Rachel Blackmore, and she fully deserves it, Joe.
Okay, we'll leave it there, Alan. Thanks for that. And
pleasure, Joe.
Happy Christmas. I'm sure we'll see you over the Christmas at some stage, but the show will be back in the new year, and we look forward to talking to you then.
And many happy returns. Thanks a million, Joe.
And happy Christmas. Okay, thanks, Alan. We're turning our attention now to rugby. You're listening to Dublin's Talking Sport. And Philip Doyle is the former Irish women's rugby team coach who joins me on the line. Good morning to you, Philip.
Morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm very good, Philip. I'm very good. Now, I want to have a chat with you. I know Reggie originally was going to chat to you about this, but about the big problem at the moment in Irish women's rugby, the poor results, lack of qualification, and now, of course, 62 current former players writing to the Minister for Sport saying they had complete lack of confidence in the IRFU. Tell us all about this. I mean, it's a big, big story.
It is. It's unprecedented, the step these players have taken. Something I didn't know that they were going to do. I knew they were up to something. But to do this, to make this move was, at first I thought, was not clever. But in hindsight, they've had to do this. Look, they had to make this move because the IRFU were not listening to these players. First of all, they wouldn't even recognise them. And you saw by the IRFU response that came back was absolutely, totally aggressive towards them and basically thrown their weight. And it's great to see that now the IRFU have decided that these women are not going to go away. These women are like a dog with a bone now, only because they've been forced into a corner. And they're not going to go away. And thankfully, the IRFU have now stepped back a little bit and to say that they're going to have the two reviews that are now going to go fully public, and which is fantastic to see. So we'll be able to see what has gone wrong. But for the future, like, that's one part of it. But for the future, what are the IRFU going to do regarding the future? And that's what really these women are after, and I should say myself, are after, because the state of women's rugby in Ireland is basically totally shambles, to be honest, from AIL up. There is no concise or clear guidance of where we have to go. Everybody in the club land is basically paddling their own canoe.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to go back to the, you know, when you were saying you didn't think it was clever, and will it set a precedent? Because normally, if you don't go to your direct boss in any, whether it's sport or business, and you kind of bypass your direct boss and you go to the top, you might get an initial. First of all, your direct boss will be very, very upset, and then they have to obviously toe the line. But what will be the repercussions? I mean, will the IRFU sort of let this go and say, okay, this is a one-off? The fact that they went to Jack Chambers and went to the minister without going to the IRFU.
Well, I do hope, Joe, it is a one-off, that the girls never have to do this move again. I do hope the IRFU are going to change now, because they tried to go to Anthony Eddy and then go to New Sephora and then go to Philip Brown, but obviously they were getting closed doors, so they had to make this move. Will it have repercussions? Yeah, I think the trust is completely and utterly broken now between the two, and it's going to take a long time for the trust on both sides to be built up again.
So,
but time is a healer.
So can you explain just to our listeners what exactly the issues were? You know what I mean? Like, we hear, you know, they're saying they don't trust the IRFU and they don't have faith in the IRFU. But what is it that they don't have faith in? What is it? What is the trust? Just for people who don't really know.
Oh, yeah. It's the planning and the pathway that women's rugby was meant to be on going forward. So they say that that women's rugby, or the ladies are thinking, basically, bar the sevens and the 15, bar the sevens mainly, and the 15s are basically a tag on to the sevens. There's nothing, there's no pathway. There's no clear and concise planning for the 15 side. Yes, for the sevens, we all can see that. They're all contracted and it's all going great, or so what. the results aren't going great, but there is a pathway there for them. But for the 15s, there's absolutely nothing. Okay. They're just put in, their players are picked, and off you go. But there's nothing underneath. There's literally nothing. There's a lot of volunteers out there doing all their work while paddling their own canoe. And that's basically it. There's no clear and concise planning.
And do you think now, because obviously there was a bit of a threat that the government may withhold some funding to the IRFU, would you think that is the main reason that the IRFU have been brought to the table? Or would that be your thoughts?
No, absolutely. Money talks. And IRFU is all about money. Not a profitable organisation. Yes, they are. they have to make money. They have to pay the bills. And yeah, it is. It is without doubt. It's the pressure from the government coming back down. And it's just a pity it's got to this stage. But unfortunately, that they forced the girls into this action. And rightly so.
And of course, this could have a knock-on effect, couldn't it, with sponsors and with the IRFU have said they're going to sort of publish the upcoming reviews. So it means that they are kind of a bit worried.
Yeah, they are. And the sponsors, I'd like to think the sponsors will stay with the ladies. What everybody needs to know is women's rugby in the world is the biggest part of rugby growth at the moment. Rugby, women's rugby is huge, and it's absolutely getting bigger and bigger around the world. So for me, just have a look at the English and the French leagues. They are pulling in massive crowds now, filling stadiums. Sponsors are coming on board. So there is a massive growth for sponsorship here. And I just hope to God that everybody, all these sponsors just stay on board and for the good of the game. So look, can things change? Yes. Can things get better? Undoubtedly better. Okay. But it's just an awful pity we have to come here.
And Philip, what needs to happen now for the IRFU to prove they're serious about addressing the issue?
They have to sit us down around the table and show us exactly what they're going to do. Be very honest. And honesty, when it comes to women, honesty is everything. So give us an honest opinion of where we're going. This isn't all about money, by the way. Money has to come into it, but it's not all about money. Just give us a clear pathway for the 15s that we all can get on board and all of these volunteers around the country can buy into and get a good, decent AIL structure in place. And that's basically it. And from there, I guarantee you, you'll see this 15s senior women's Irish team starting to do really well, especially under Greg. The new Greg McWilliams, the new coach, has come in. He's a superb coach. I worked with him really closely in years gone by, and that man has the gift. He can do it. He just needs the backing of everybody in the country.
Okay, well, that's great. Listen, thanks for that, Philip. So very interesting insight into what was happening, and maybe just throwing a light for a lot of people who kind of see it as a passing story, but it is a big story within the IRFU, no doubt about that.
Yes.
And we're turning our attention to GAA, and we know that Colman Goggins was the successful Dublin Leinster football winning skipper back in 2002 under Tommy Lyons. Declan Drake sat down with the Ballantyre St John's club man to get his thoughts and opinions on Dublin's turbulent year in Gaelic football.
Okay, the curtain is about to come down on 2021. The last big match of the year takes place this evening at Croke Park. Kilmacud Croke's going to qualify for a Leinster Championship final against Port Arlington of Laois at Croke Park. And we wish Robbie and the crew there every success in their endeavours this evening. But now, absolutely delighted to be joined on the programme by Colman Goggins, the man who led Dublin to that Leinster Championship title back in 2002. It was a great, great day in Croke Park indeed. And Colman is going to look back at the year that was 2021. From a Dublin football perspective. First of all, Colman, thank you very much indeed for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us and to have this little review. It's great to have you on the programme.
Hi Declan, how's it going? Thanks a million, nice to be invited on.
Yeah, no bother. Now, the year was very much fragmented, as we know. It didn't start until May because of the situation that we're still involved with COVID. It didn't start that well from a Dublin perspective. It must be said, not the only team to have breached the training ban, but certainly the most high-profile team. The effect of that was we didn't have our manager, Desi Farrell, for the duration of the league, and we lost the home game against Kerry as well. Didn't turn out too bad in the end, ultimately, because we shared the league title with Kerry. But what was your overall assessment of the early months of the season, Colman?
Yeah, look, I guess in general it's been a very tough year for everyone outside of GAA and outside of sport, and then when you put a GAA lens on it, you know, it becomes a little bit narrower in that you're looking at specifics. The Dublin team themselves came out and said what, you know, happened in respect to that was wrong. The Dublin County Board dealt with it very efficiently at the time, and Desi obviously served out a suspension on the sidelines. And in fairness to them, throughout the league, there looked to be signs at times that they were developing their game a little bit. They were certainly causing big problems for some of the teams throughout the league, specifically the Kerry League game below in Thurles. You mentioned that loss of home advantage. You know, there was periods in that game where they were slicing through the Kerry defence and creating goal chances, which they took a good number of them. And maybe, just maybe, there were signs of the second half shivers that Dublin got throughout 2021 that showed in that game, where Kerry obviously had a fantastic second half, racked up a big score, points only, and huge contributions from David Clifford, Sean O'Shea and the likes. And you know, it's very easy now in hindsight to say there was maybe the signs that Dublin weren't going to be able to knit together those 70-80 minutes that are needed to win All-Ireland titles. But you know, they would have been pleased enough with the way the league went. They competed well, they tried out a couple of new guys, they identified a couple of new players. So I imagine Desi was heading in for championship territory relatively happy, despite the fact that he had missed out on being on the sideline. Mick Galvin had obviously run the ship well while he was missing, so they were probably feeling that they were in okay shape heading into championship, and that's all you can probably hope to achieve coming out of the league over the last number of years. The league has obviously been a huge platform for teams to go on and be successful in championship. Maybe back in my time, league wasn't where you were split, certainly when I certainly first came into the Dublin setup. You had a couple of games before Christmas, a number of games after Christmas, so it was fragmented at that time, and maybe the league was very much about trying guys out and just keeping things ticking over. You know, now the league is very much a building block towards championship, and if you come out of the league in good shape, you go into championship in good shape. So Desi probably was happy enough with where they were at that stage, I imagine.
Certainly remember those days. Alright, we play two or three games before Christmas and then take the break and come back afterwards. All very much changed now. And then it was, first of all, just in the final point in relation to the league, would you have been disappointed that there was no league final for the integrity of the competition? I mean, Dublin and Kerry and Croke Park would have been a fantastic occasion, but the powers that be were thinking a little bit ahead of themselves, with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah, look, every competition deserves to have a final, so you have an ultimate winner that steps out of it, and a league final, Dublin Kerry would have, you know, been a showstopper, no doubt about it. They always are. But I guess across any of the leagues that teams are competing in, or any championships are competing in, you want to have an ultimate winner, you want to have a final, you want to have a showpiece. That didn't occur in the league, unfortunately. Was it the right or wrong decision? Well, look, you know, time moves on, and whether it was or it wasn't. Yeah, look, I suppose only Desi and Stephen and maybe a couple of others know, you know, what was the reasoning behind Stephen taking a break or stepping away from it, or and Desi coming out with an announcement that you know, he was still part of the setup, albeit he wasn't going to be togging out in goals. You know, from, you know, Desi's point of view, to lose someone like Stephen Cluxton, the experiences have, was always going to be a challenge to replace him, and that's not being disrespectful to Evan Comerford or anyone else who played in goals. They're certainly coming after somebody who set the bar particularly high. From Stephen's point of view, he's been involved in Dublin football for 20 odd years and had a significantly successful period, captain in Dublin to consecutive All-Ireland finals over a 4 or 5 year period. So I mean, that doesn't happen by chance. That happens by a guy being totally focused, tuned in and delivering year after year for Dublin. So they will know what, I suppose, the you know, the reasonings behind Stephen stepping away or not stepping away, or whatever the decision was around it. From a Dublin perspective, you know, it did leave a question mark over the whole time. Would he or would he not be around? Could it have been dealt with a little bit better? Again, in hindsight, maybe, you know, an announcement could have been said that he wouldn't be back, but maybe they didn't know that at the time. Maybe there was a discussion that he would be still in the fringes of the panel or would potentially come back. So I suppose Desi is trying to address things as best he can without alienating someone, without, you know, fracturing the camp, I guess, in some respects. So you're probably trying to marry a whole load of things, keep all the balls in the air, not let anyone down, try and keep the show on the road. So, you know, Desi's announcement was what it was. You know, Stephen being in missing for Dublin throughout the year, you know, certainly had an impact given his experience and what he's done here today, heretofore. But you know, it was, I suppose, a small element of maybe a summer that, you know, just, you know, unravelled for Dublin a little bit as it progressed.
And then, of course, on the other side, if you have the point of view that, well, Stephen is Stephen, what he's given to Dublin football and over the years, he deserves the space not to make his own decision. But there was no decision ultimately one way or the other at that time. We went on, we won Leinster again. We're into an All-Ireland semi-finals, the old foes of Mayo in Croke Park. Going into extra time that day, Colman, did you believe still in your heart that we could pull it out of the fire?
In respect to the league, Dublin were able to put these performances together in the first half, and particularly against Mayo, it looked like they had mapped out what they needed to do, had built out a lead, had created some scoring opportunities that they didn't take, and Mayo had created a few as well. And I remember looking back after the game where James Horan, despite, you know, a lot of people saying Mayo hadn't played well and it was the same old story, and they had created chances, just hadn't taken them. So they felt they were challenging Dublin, even though it looked like Dublin had been totally in control. The second half was concerning, and that Dublin just couldn't seem to knit things together, and that was a bit of a theme throughout the championship. You know, the Meath came back at them, you know, they left little windows all the time, and going into extra time, but it was just that Mayo had got this impetus, and when there was a bit of a gap in times past, maybe Mayo haven't kicked that gap open to forwards a bigger hole for them to get through. And I think through extra time stuff happened for them and worked for them against Dublin's just their inability to get into a bit of a groove or get into a bit of momentum. And as the extra time progressed, there was only ever going to be one winner, because it just looked like Mayo had all the cards that were stacked up for them. Mayo had made a massive call in pulling Aidan O'Shea off the field, and that seemed to benefit them. Dublin had a couple of guys that picked up knocks, a couple of guys that they would have looked to carry ball for them, maybe weren't able to do that in that extra time period, and looked a little bit tired at that point. And why would they not be after the run that they've been on for so many years? So long story short, to answer your original question, did I see? I always thought that they'd come out of it with a result. I thought they were going to be better than Mayo from well before the game ever started to the close to the very end. But through extra time then, you could just see that things weren't clicking for them, and unfortunately it wasn't Dublin's day. And credit to Mayo, the gap that was there, they grabbed,
couldn't go on and seal the deal, of course, as we know, because Tyrone were crowned All-Ireland champions as well, coming out of the pack, which is where Dublin are going to have to come out of next year, Colman, for the first time since Jim Gavin's time back in 2014-2015. It's a new experience. Do you think there's less pressure now on them, or perhaps a little bit more to get back to where they were? How would you assess it now?
Yeah, look, I think from a Dublin perspective, we were obviously disappointed that they didn't make it to another All-Ireland final. From a national perspective and from a Gaelic Games perspective, I'm sure I won't call it a novel pairing, but the pairing of Tyrone and Mayo threw up something a little bit fresh, and that people were able to get in behind it again, and a lot of people were pulling for Mayo. Tyrone have a great knack of finding an angle against teams regardless, and it reminds me a little bit of Dublin in 2011. They developed this ruthless streak, so that if there was a half chance for a goal, they went for it, and more often than not they took it. Kevin McMenamin's goal, case in point, and Tyrone managed to do that. So, you know, in terms of the All-Ireland final, it was brilliant for a team to show that ruthless streak, which takes a team above, you know, nearly been there to getting there. And that's not meant as being disrespectful to Mayo. Mm-hmm. Tyrone were able to seize on something, grab a hold of it and get over the line. So it does put Dublin back into the pack, because Tyrone won the All-Ireland, Mayo bet Dublin. So invariably you fall as number three in the pecking order as it sits, looking at All-Ireland, we'll say, you know. We'd carry then, well, we maybe are joint third, if not ahead of you in that instance, you know. So Dublin certainly come back into the pack. So is it pressure on or pressure off? I'd say it's a fresh start in some respects. So is it the end of an era? We won't know that till next summer and we see where Dublin land. Certainly it was the end of a run that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, particularly during my time playing, trying to get to an All-Ireland final was a challenge. Yeah. So to win, you know, six of them on the spin and eight in, you know, a 10, 11 year period or whatever is a phenomenal achievement by the group and by the players who've come and gone and are still there at the moment. So I think there's huge potential for the team to start again and start afresh. There's probably a need to uncover new talent, or at the very least see if some of the talent that's out there that's not currently involved could come back into the fold different, and then Ulster football, you just don't know how that's going to play out. So there's huge opportunity for every other county, given that Dublin maybe have come back into the pack a little bit, but within that there's huge opportunity for Dublin to reset the bar again and go again.
Of course, we are talking now as if everything is going to be fantastically glorious in 2022 and this COVID situation will be gone. Please God it will. We've definitely had enough of it at this stage. But just to, if you can finish on the club championship, Kilmacud Crokes, as we say, playing a little bit later now against Port Arlington of Laois in Croke Park, which is a fantastic opportunity for them to play in Croke Park for a lot of their younger players this evening. But the overall standard, Coleman, 2021 of the Dublin Club Championship, were you impressed with the quality of what you saw, and are there shoots there for Desi Farrell to go and look at in terms of new fresh talent?
Yeah, I think there was. I think if you look at the likes of Lucan, who are a relatively young team, have a couple of guys that are potentially looking to shake up things. You have, you know, the teams that are nearly always around, the Ballybodens, St. Jude's. I was hugely impressed with Jude's this year. I'd seen them a couple of times. Really thought that they had a great shape to them. They were set up very well defensively. They were able to get out at pace, and then they had a couple of guys up front could get them scores, and they weren't over reliant as they had been maybe in previous years on Kevin McManaman. So I was hugely impressed with Jude's. I know they've a number of guys maybe who don't qualify for Dublin, unfortunately, but then within that there's potential for other guys to, you know, get to the level of the guys they're playing with, and then challenge for place within Dublin setup. So there's certainly and before moving on, the Kilmacud Crokes, when you think defensively how they man a man against guys and restrict the impact on games. Now they certainly know how to play defensively, don't get me wrong, but they've some very, very strong one on one defenders, and hopefully some of those guys can progress into Desi setup and start getting a little bit more game time. So I do think there's talent coming through. I do think the Dublin Championship was, you know, very competitive, particularly towards the latter stages. You know, the final maybe was quite defensive in the, you know, opening 50 minutes.
I thought it was in Dalymount Park watching a game for a long time because it was nil all.
Yeah, well, that's a fair call. Look, it was very defensive. Maybe it didn't showcase what's there in terms of talent, but, you know, when you're St. Jude's and you've been so close, you're going to try something a little bit different to try and get over the line. So it didn't work out for them. Kilmacud Crokes managed to get over the line, and I suppose the impact of their bench was probably, you know, 1-2 came off the bench that day, which was probably the big impact for them. So the standard is good, the quality is good. Is there enough new faces that Desi can draw to hopefully build on the Dublin setup? I think there probably are one or two. I think there's also the guys within the panel already who will be chomping at the bit to go again. And then, as I mentioned, maybe there's one or two fellas who've been there before that might be interested in coming back into this setup. If they are, great, gives Dublin a lift, and if not, then, well, you've got to make do with what you have and hope that 2022, COVID aside, allows people to express themselves on a football field and Dublin to challenge again.
Well, as you said at the start, Coleman, it was the season did only start in May, but here we are in December. It seems like a lifetime ago now with everything that we've gone through over the last few months. I'm sure that you will enjoy your Christmas break before you resume your media duties in 2022 with the excellent service, it must be said, that TG Carr have provided over the years for us.
Yeah, look, you know, I can't. TG Carr have been very good to me, and they allow me to get out to matches, because if I said to my wife that I was going out to match, there'd probably be a big no. When I say I'm going out with TG Carr, she says, right, off you go. Look, I think it's a great service. It's I was just looking there online during the week, the amount of GA that's on over the weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, coverage through obviously RTE, coverage through TG Carr, and then it's some of those games you don't ever get to see that TG Carr managed to land on, that are, you know, those nuggets in the pot as well. So no, credit to everyone from a GA point of view that they get the matches out there, and hopefully everyone can stay safe and well going to those matches, and that there's, you know, not restrictions placed and we can't get to the games, because I suppose that's what most people enjoy, getting out and watching games in obviously safety at that point.
Once again, it's been a pleasure to sit down and talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for that. We wish you and your family every peace and happiness for Christmas, and please God 2022, Coleman, may be a blue year for us all.
Thanks for listening to Dublin's Talking Sport and Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken, and Reggie. Have a good weekend.